are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Children International is working to end child poverty around the world by giving kids access to a safe place, a team, and a path out of poverty by focusing on health, education, empowerment, and employment. Together with people like you, we're more than a nonprofit. We're a powerful force for change. Learn more at children.org.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history from the University of Michigan, author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, Professor Juan Cole, on Mosul, Yemen. Also on the program today, more polls, more or less the same. And how Trump made lying to investors legal.
Big league.
Also, the alleged Trump rape victim cancels her press conference. I don't know. Progressives already pushing back on Chuck Schumer and, in parens, Hillary Clinton's repatriation tax deal. And some sort of surprising voices. The DOJ says to North Carolina, hey, stop purposely disenfranchising black people from voting.
No, I think we got a different view on that down here.
Yeah, no, just a reminder, that's illegal, what you're doing.
I think you'll find that we can make it legal.
Mississippi, a church burned and just signed Vote Trump. Brexit on hold. Brexhold. Hexit. Exiled.
Brexit exit.
Brexit exited.
Yeah. Sometimes you guys get a little carried away with yourselves.
And lastly, GMOs don't seem to be all that they're cracked up to be.
Oh, fuck.
Begin the deluge of phone calls. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Thursday, November 3rd, as you will recall. We said that just moments ago. And that means that we are 5 shopping days away from the presidential election. It is almost unimaginable that this is going to end, at least the election. Nothing else will end after that. We're still going to be, we're still going to have Donald Trump to kick around. He's advertising, right?
Bar, Trump, stock.
It would be awesome if we could do the whole show.
In Hindi.
Majority Report Hindi.
I mean, it also probably would be, we could probably be the number one American politics podcast in India.
A beaky bar, Sam Seat, social security bar.
All I can tell you in terms of what is new right now is just that Paul Ryan voted for Donald Trump. They're all voting for Donald Trump. And people are just trying to get their last licks in to remind people that this is the Republican Party. Donald Trump is out there, furthering the narrative. As he basically said, look, let's do the count here. We have 3 U.S. senators who said that they will not, under any circumstances, confirm a President Clinton's nominees. John McCain, and the wacko bird called by John McCain, Ted Cruz, the third senator is Burr, running in North Carolina. Meanwhile, Ron Johnson, talk about a Hail Mary. He is already talking about impeachment. Down 5 or 7 points, I think, in Wisconsin. I mean, just contemplate this. This is like much full time, but nullification.
I'm sorry. Can that really play well in a place like Wisconsin?
I think it is it's full on desperation. I mean, I think it's desperation time. Like the only hope he has is there's going to be voters. And this is real. In Milwaukee, there is going to be intense voter suppression, and in other places in Wisconsin. And I think his gambit is, and again, like I say, this is a Hail Mary. I think he's thinking, hopefully, even though I'm down in the polls, if 10% of those people can't vote, and I can motivate my base out there because they think I'm going to impeach Hillary Clinton. It just gives you a sense. It just goes back to what I've been saying for throughout this campaign and before it. This is who the Republican Party is. Yeah, crazy. Crazy. And nihilists. I mean, this is about just fundamentally undermining our whole process of government. Trump, I think, said yesterday that if she wins, it would be completely illegitimate. I mean, you know, leave it to Trump at least to not have to put a text on top of that subtext. I was on Hayes last night. You know what that means. I had to shave. But when I shave, it's not the painful, annoying experience it used to be. Because not only do I not a big fan of shaving, but to sit there and hold something in your hand that you know you overpaid for to do something that you don't want to do, is there any worse experience? Well, I don't have that problem anymore. And you know why, folks. Harry's. Big razor companies have that annoying habit of putting out new models, raising their already high prices. It's like some type of razor wars, like a razor race, like an arms race. But they're competing against themselves, so they have to come up with some type of like bizarre technology. Like our razor actually will I don't know, talk to you when it hits your chin or something. I have no idea. But unlike those guys, Harry's doesn't believe in upcharging, which is why they made their razors even better, and they're keeping their prices exactly the same. Harry's five-blade razors now include softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, trimmer blade for harder-reach places. I've already spoken about my appreciation of that because of some weird nose dynamic I have. A lubricating strip, textured handle for more control when it's wet. Still, just $2 a blade compared to the $4 at least you'll pay at the drugstore. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they'll send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, a five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel free when you sign up for a shave plan. You just pay the shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of this show. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT. That is derived from the name of the show, Majority Report. At checkout to get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout. Claim your free trial set and your post-shave balm. That's harrys.com, code MAJORITYREPORT. Yes, Kelly, you had a question.
It's not a question. It's a statement. Harry's is great for ladies as well. I have tried it, and it's the best razor I've ever had.
All right.
No lie.
Fair enough.
Well.
Although I don't know.
I'm starting to wonder if you
balms.
Have a side deal with Harry's.
I wish.
That would actually be very clever. That's what happened at Air America. They brought on Montel Williams because they wanted to. The website was going to be really liberal. The radio station was going to be centrist or independent. Oh my God. But they thought, oh, Montel Williams, he's going to bring us in huge advertising. And he had all these side deals. And so he kept inviting the head of LifeLock on the show.
And at one point, like 2 months into it, like the advertising guys go, like, we go to LifeLock, we can't even get them to advertise. And then they realize, like, oh, it's because he's doing it and just getting paid directly.
That's so weird. I have just as much, you know, advertising
juice
as Montel.
Montel, yeah. That is weird.
Yeah, I haven't gotten any offers.
All right, I want to talk about this briefly. Are we going to have time for this Comey thing? I don't think so. No. I want to talk about President Obama actually came out and spoke about Comey. The Comey thing, I will get to it in the fun half. I mean, excuse me, in the free part of the show. But first, I want to tell you that right now I'm in the opposite of the doghouse at home. What is the opposite of the doghouse? I guess just the normal house. I'm in the house.
The big house.
I'm in the big house. Why?
That's not good.
Two words, silver pearl. What does that mean? I mean, you know what silver pearl means.
Happy wife.
Yes. I'm not a big watch guy, but I got a watch from Movement, and I got a women's watch. Nikki wanted the silver pearl. She loves it. It makes her feel like she's a professional. I'm not saying she's not professional acting. I'm just saying. Movement watches start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Now, I wouldn't tell you that if I thought that Nikki was listening, because I sort of may have implied that the watch was a little more expensive. Movement figured out by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism, over 500,000 watches sold in over 160 countries. Check this out. You get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmtwatches.com/majority. That's mvmtwatches.com/majority. This watch, I'll tell you something. It has a clean design. She has been, like, literally every time she puts it, maybe not every time, but more often than not, when she puts it on, I get a thank you for this. I love it. Like, she does it on a daily basis. What?
That's very nice of her.
That's very nice of her.
Yeah.
I think it's the watch. Now's the time to step up your watch game. Go to mvmtwatches.com/majority. Get your 15% off. Join the movement. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Juan Cole. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Juan Cole. He is a professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of, at the very least, his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks, Sam.
So let's start with Mosul, because this is in the news. I mean, Yemen is, of course, too. But Mosul seems like a fairly good place to start. There was news, I guess, reported today that al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, released an audio recording that was meant to encourage ISIS fighters. It's not clear when this was recorded, though, as far as I can tell. Give us a sense of what's happening in Mosul at this point.
Well, Mosul is more or less surrounded by a variety of Iraqi forces that are intent on taking the city away from ISIL. And There have been some defections, and apparently there was an attempted revolt on the part of the ISIL police against Baghdadi, because they know they're doomed. I mean, this is not the first time we've seen this movie. They had Ramadi, they had Fallujah, they had Tikrit, they had a number of Sunni Arab Iraqi cities, and the Iraqi forces have defeated them in each of them serially, so it's only a matter of time till they fall in Mosul.
Give us a sense, when we say Iraqi forces, I mean, give us a sense of the array of groups that seem to be fighting, or that are fighting, I guess, in this battle.
Well, the effort is being spearheaded by the 9th Armored Division of the Iraqi Army. And it is being helped by three brigades of the Army's Counterterrorism Division. So that's the core of the assault from the south, from Baghdad. In addition, they are coordinating with and getting help from the Kurdistan Regional Government's National Guard, which are called the Peshmerga. And also local Sunni Arab rural clans have put up tribal levies that are fighting. They initially were trying to discourage the Shiite militias from going in because Mosul is Sunni Arab territory, and having hardline Shiite militias allied with Iran foregrounded in this effort is bad optics, as they say in the military.
My understanding. Okay, good.
Yeah,
sorry.
Please. No, go ahead.
Well, my understanding is that they are sending in only those Sunni forces into Mosul, and they're trying to keep the Shiite forces, and to the extent that there's any, I guess, what you call them, paramilitary or just sort of, I guess, just Shiite brigades or troops, not necessarily in the Iraqi army on the outskirts of Mosul.
That's right. The regular army and the Sunni Arab clans are the ones that are envisaged as going into the city. So, of course, when you invest a city like this, it's useful to have it surrounded, and the Iraqi army hasn't rebuilt to the point where I think it can surround. So it's using the Peshmerga and the Kurdish forces, and the Shiite militias now have joined in to try to close off escape routes to ISIL, to Syria. So they're helping surround the city. But they won't be the forces that go in. That'll be the regular army and maybe some of the Sunni forces.
And do we have a sense of how much of the ISIL leadership is in Mosul? I mean, to hear Donald Trump tell it, it was a huge mistake to let everybody know that they were going into Mosul. I'm not sure exactly how you keep that secret, but to transmit it because all the leadership is going to escape Mosul.
Well, the capital of ISIL is this small city in eastern Syria named Raqqa. And when they took Mosul, some of the leadership transferred there because it's a big city. I mean, before these events, it probably had 2 million people in the metropolitan area. This is like Houston or something. So that's a much bigger fief to run, and there isn't a lot of evidence of the leadership that had come to Mosul leaving. And in fact, this audio tape you mentioned of Baghdadi urges people to stay and fight to the death.
I mean, wouldn't
so
go ahead?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just
the Trump thesis that letting them know we're coming would allow them to escape doesn't seem like they have escape on their minds. They're a millenarian sect, you know. They think that this is their Armageddon.
I would imagine it also would have been undercut the. In we're talking about, like you say, there are millions of civilians here, and I imagine that there is a tremendous civilian you know, casualty count. And I would imagine that if your leadership left the city, it would help end the battle quicker.
Oh, yeah. If the leadership had run away to Raqqa, then likely there would just be an internal city revolt and you wouldn't have to conquer it. And indeed, as I said, there are some signs of internal restiveness, even on the part of some of the ISIL fighters. But that doesn't seem to be on their minds. I mean, the fact is that since 2014, when ISIL took over 40% of Iraqi territory, the Obama administration has tried to rebuild the Iraqi army, which had collapsed. And they have serially taken all of these cities, Tikrit and Fallujah and Ramadi and so forth. So if you just watch the map, it's very clear that they're coming for Mosul next. There's no way to keep that secret. That's silly.
And do we have a sense of what kind of civilian casualties the people of Mosul are suffering?
Well, we don't have any access to internal affairs inside Mosul because it's ISIL-held territory, and they tend to cut the heads off of journalists. What we can say is this, that, the city used to have 2 million people, maybe 2.5. I think it's down to a little over 1 million. People, through the last 2 years have fled. The evidence is that ISIL isn't letting the rest of them leave, that ideally, from the point of view of the Iraqi army, it would have been much better if the civilians could just flee. But ISIL won't let them. And sometimes it'll let people leave if they turn over all their property to them and so forth. But I think under these circumstances where they're under attack, they understand the civilians are an asset. And they can use them as cover. As you move into these, as the army moves into these neighborhoods, and there's hand-to-hand fighting in alleyways, and they're calling down airstrikes on buildings that are being used as ISIL headquarters, there certainly will be, civilian casualties. There will also be a wave. An enormous wave of refugees who do manage, as ISIL weakens, to flee the city, probably to Kurdistan.
Do we know how many ISIL fighters there are? I've read that there are up to 100,000 Iraqi troops. Do we have a sense of how many ISIL troops there are?
Oh, inside Mosul, the estimate is between 4 to 9,000. And I would favor the lower number. It was never a really big force, ISIL as a guerrilla movement, and it really was only able to take over Mosul because the Iraqi army ran away and collapsed, and B, because the Baghdad government was relatively unpopular in Mosul, and especially with some of the city elites who thought that they would be able to handle ISIL when they invited it in. And then, ISIL took them away in the middle of the night and took over. But it wasn't by, conventional main force. There wasn't like a tank line that took the city. It was political. And they are very good at booby trapping and suicide bombing. They use suicide bombing as a tactical element in their fighting. So if you're in a back alley and you're down to hand-to-hand fighting, they'll jump off the roof down onto the opposing army and blow themselves up. And it's from all accounts, terrifying.
Aye. And so what happens to ISIL once the Iraqi army has fully secured Mosul?
Well, ISIL began as a terrorist organization. It was earlier in its genesis, Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia under Abu Musab Zarqawi. And to the extent that it survives this series of defeats that's being inflicted on it, it will demobilize back into a terrorist organization. So I think it clearly has the by now the experience, the training, the determination, and the access to high explosives that will allow it to go on haunting Iraq and Syria for a long time. I think we can expect terrorist attacks from it. It could lash out, in its territorial defeat at Europe. So, it will be rolled up as a government, as a state, which is what its point of pride was, that it had emerged from being a terrorist organization to being a state. It will not remain a state, but it will remain a terrorist organization, and it could be even more deadly, having been deprived of territory than it was before.
Why is that? Just simply because they don't have to. They don't have to work on defense. That they can simply. They're simply sort of a roving force. Will they be based in Western Iraq, or do they basically head back to Syria and launch what they're going to launch from Syria?
Well, they after they lose Mosul, they will have no territory in Iraq. But they survived for years in Iraq in the zeros, in urban neighborhoods and in villages with cells. They'll go back to a cell-like organization inside Iraq. In Syria, they still have a rump territory. They have half of Raqqa province and they have Deir ez-Zor province. They will probably lose those two provinces over the course of the next year in Syria. So I expect them to end up being deprived of territory. I think they won't be able to function as a government or as a governmental bureaucracy anyplace. They won't have control of any substantial territory. They might have a neighborhood here or there or a village here or there. But they will still be operational cells, and they'll be vengeful. They'll want to get back what they've lost. Some of them, of course, will be discouraged, and the movement will be much smaller. It'll just be a handful of true believers. But you could imagine them wanting to pull off something spectacular in Europe just to make the point that we're still here. We haven't been completely defeated. We're still coming for you. This is what I worry about.
And just moving a little bit north here, what's going on with Turkey and Iraq? My understanding is that there was some, I think it was today, it was reported that the Iraqi government was like, well, if Turkey wants to have a war with us, we'll have a war with them. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here a little bit and simplifying it, but my understanding is that Turkey is now amassing some hardware on the Turkish-Iraqi border. Do you have any sense of what's going on there?
Well, I think several things are going on. First of all, there is some danger of ISIL operatives fleeing from Iraq into Turkey. And I think the government in Turkey is determined not to let that happen. There's kind of a persistent urban legend in the United States that Turkey is somehow behind ISIL or hooked up with it. Actually, Turkey is very afraid of ISIL. It wasn't their first priority to fight, but they don't like it, and it has pulled off some bombings in Turkey that have really damaged the economy. So I think partly they don't want a wave of ISIL fighters entering Turkey from Iraq. The other thing, though, I think, as far as I can tell, is that Turkey is beginning to assert an interest in northern Iraq, which is largely Sunni Arab, as a sphere of influence. And, this is an old diplomatic ploy going back to the 19th century that a power will, it's like the British said, Belgium is our sphere of influence, so Germany should stay out. And I think Turkey is kind of thinking of itself as an external element that would offer some protection to the Sunni Arabs of northern Iraq from any excesses of, say, the Shiite Iran-backed militias. It's playing politics, you know, in another country. And Baghdad, of course, doesn't want part of its territory to become somebody else's sphere of influence and is pushing back against this. Turkey does have a small base inside Iraq at Bashika near Mosul, and it has been training local Sunni Arab militiamen for this assault on Mosul. And I think Turkey is looking to turn that effort into political influence inside Iraq.
And to what ends? I mean, what I mean is it simply to push back on sort of, I guess, the Iranians extending their sphere of influence? Is it to prevent the Kurds that they don't like who are from finding safe haven in Western Iraq? What's ultimately their agenda? Or is it just simply makes us feel good to?
No, they have interests. First of all, you're quite right that, you know, there are Kurdish expansionists. You have this Kurdish super province, the Kurdistan Regional Government in northern Iraq, which has more or less de facto taken over the province of Kirkuk. It used to be three Iraqi provinces, and they've added a fourth by fiat after the rise of ISIL. And there are maps, you know, on the part of, on the part of the Kurdish expansionists that show Mosul as Kurdish territory. And I think one of the things that's going on is Turkey is placing a marker and saying, no, that's not going to be allowed. Iranian, you know, the Turks kind of now are engaged in a very strange dance with Iran in the sense that they are backing the Sunni Arab rebels in Syria against the pro-Iranian Hezbollah and the pro-Iranian regime in Damascus on the Syrian side. And I think they all are also concerned that, you know, Mosul not basically fall into the hands of people who are pro-Iran. It's an odd thing because there are also friendly relations between Turkey and Iran. They seem to be able to separate out things like gas, natural gas buys, and certain other, you know, fields of diplomacy from this regional struggle in Syria and Iraq over influence.
What happens once ISIL is defeated in Iraq, at least as a military force, as opposed to a terrorist force?
I think it depends. It's a really good question. It depends a lot on what Baghdad does politically. So, you know, I have Iraqi friends and analysts who disagree with me about this, but I think it's not just, you know, Sunni irredentism that they had been in control of the country under Saddam Hussein and the Americans upset their apple cart and they're you know, vengeful and ambitious and upset. But I think also the new government that came in under Bush was Shiite and Kurdish dominated. And the Sunni Arabs felt that they just didn't have, you know, a means of participating meaningfully in the new politics. And they went from being the WASPs of Iraq to being the African Americans of Iraq. And so they are upset, and they feel like they're not getting the share of the oil wealth, they're not getting the services, and they're not getting the political power that's commensurate with their standing in the country. And I think that what happened in 2014 when ISIL took over most of the Sunni Arab areas, it was a kind of secession. It was like the American Civil War that they seceded from Baghdad. And so Haider al-Abadi is playing Lincoln here. But then you have reconstruction, and you have to find a way of drawing the Sunni Arabs of Iraq back into national politics and offering them a place at the table. And if that's done successfully, then ISIL goes away. But if it's botched and people remain resentful and feeling that they're discriminated against or that there's no hope for them to to have a place at that table in Baghdad, then, you know, we'll be here again in 10 years.
Is there a will? I mean, because my sense is that there was no will to bring the Sunni in 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago. Is there a will to do so now? I mean, is there, I mean, are we in one of those sort of equilibriums where sort of everyone understands that this could all be, there's just a lot to be lost if there's not a genuine attempt at some type of actually, I don't know, unified government?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a will. I think Haider al-Abadi, the new prime minister, is a much more inclusive and less abrasive figure than his predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki. And Maliki was a, you know, conspirator for 20 years to try to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And he really didn't trust Sunni Arabs and didn't like to meet with them. I think Haider al-Abadi is a different kind of person. But the real problem, it's more parties. There are four major political blocs in Iraq, and they're ethnically and sectarian based, and this is very bad. It's a legacy to some extent of the way that Bush ran the country. What you need is a labor party, so the Kurdish workers and the Sunni Arab workers and the Shiite workers could all support it across the board, and maybe, you know, you could have a pro-business party and so forth. They haven't organized themselves on those kinds of bases where you'd have nationwide parties. The Dawah Party, which Haider al-Abadi belongs to, is the Islamic Call Party, is Shiite fundamentalists, the Sunni Arabs don't vote for the Dawah Party, and so they're not al-Abadi's constituency. Then you have other Shiite parties like that of Muqtada Sadr or Ammar al-Hakim, which are very Shiite and don't have Sunni followers. And then you have a Kurdistan Alliance, which is, you know, the two major Kurdish parties. And then you've had a variety of groups that have tried to represent the Sunni Arabs, whether they're secular or religious, and which have mostly collapsed. So as long as you organize your parliamentary politics on these kinds of bases, then the Sunni Arabs are a powerless and minority that are odd man out. So I think the party system has to be redone, and maybe the Constitution needs to be rewritten. And I don't see, a push for that kind of reform from this government, from this parliament. They don't show signs of understanding what they need to do to get the country back together.
How much is Iranian influence actively impacting this dynamic? I mean, is it hardening things? Are they as influential as they have been over the past 5 to 10 years? More so? Do we have a sense of just where they are in this mix?
Well, you know, the Baghdad government views Iran as a friendly force and does depend on it for certain things. And Iran has been important in, I think, probably paying and training and mobilizing the Shiite militias that have played a big role in taking back the country from Daesh, from ISIL. But the al-Abadi government itself is not particularly close to Iran, or is certainly not a puppet of Iran. The Dawah Party that al-Abadi represents doesn't accept the Iranian doctrine that clerics should rule. It's a lay party. You know, it's a party of school teachers and doctors and lawyers. And al-Abadi has never been known as someone who's sycophantic towards Iran. And I think Iran itself, the government of Hassan Rouhani, is perfectly aware that it's not good for Iran to have Iraq in shambles this way. And so the Iranians really want to see ISIL defeated. But I don't think they're pushing the Baghdad government to be punitive towards the Sunnis. Uh, And in fact, you know, there's some evidence in the past that under al-Maliki that the Iranians thought he was going too far and that he should reach out to the Sunnis.
Hmm. All right. So let's move south and talk about what's happening in Yemen. There's been ongoing, I don't know if I would call them peace talks, but ceasefire talks. The Samantha Power, who is our ambassador to the UN, criticized the Saudi war essentially against Yemen. I mean, I guess that's a fair characterization, which is odd because in many respects we seem to be enabling that to a certain degree, or at least, if not enabling it is too strong, certainly contributing to that effort. Give me a sense of where we're at. And just also for people who don't fully understand, can you just sort of set the context for why Saudi Arabia has been actively bombing Yemen?
Right. So Yemen was part of the youth revolutions of 2011 and after, and the long-lived dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was overthrown early in 2012 by that revolution. His vice president became the president in a referendum, and a constitutional process was set in place of writing a new constitution, moving towards new parliamentary elections. And it was slow. It was unsatisfactory, but it was happening. And there was room for some optimism. But then in fall of 2014 and into 2015, one of the factions in northern Yemen that had originally opposed the government was the Houthis. This is a relatively militant sect coming out of the Zaydi Shiite group, which is about a third of Yemenis and predominates in the north. But they had organized as a militia, almost like Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they took over. And then in early 2015, they deposed the elected president and ultimately chased him out of the country. And then they took over not only the north where the Zaydis predominate, but they took over some southern areas down to the port of Aden. Well, the Houthis, I don't think it's terribly important that they come from a Shiite branch of Islam. They're not like the Iranian or Iraqi Shiites, and they're kind of in between Sunni and Shiite. But the important thing to know about them is that they really resent the Saudis. They feel like Saudi Arabia has been oppressive and has tried to proselytize them and turn them into Wahhabis, which is a really rigid and hardline form of Sunni Islam, and that the government was letting them, you know, the Saudis were bringing in all this money and setting up centers and proselytizing them, and they really resented, they revolted against this. So they've talked about, you know, overthrowing the government in Riyadh. And if you know anything about the Saudis, having a neighboring country ruled by a militant Shiite sect that says it wants to overthrow the Saudi monarchy is just not going to be allowed. And so the Saudis mobilized to kick the Houthis back out of the southern port of Aden and hooked up with forces in the military still loyal to the deposed second president, Mansour Hadi, and then have pursued largely an air war against the Houthis, who continue to control, North Yemen. That's a stupid military policy because you can't defeat a guerrilla group with air power.
And what has the U.S. role been in terms of both providing resources to Saudi Arabia, but also in terms of, you know, how much has the U.S. been actively involved in in this entire process. I mean, clearly we've been involved in our own semi-secret war there with drones for years now. Where does that intersect with what Saudi Arabia is doing?
Well, you know, the Saudis maintain that the Houthi rebels are puppets of Iran. This is not true. They are an indigenous movement, and as I said, they don't follow the kind of Shiism that's in Iran. They may have gotten a little bit of money from the Iranians and a few weapons. I don't know, but it's nothing significant. Most of their weapons are American. They captured them from the Yemeni army depots, and a significant portion of the army that was loyal to Ali Abdullah Saleh has now joined in with them. So the Americans, however, seem to have bought this line that the Houthis are somehow an Iranian cat's paw. And moreover, my own view of it is that Obama, you know, really angered the Saudis, who are a longtime ally in the region, with his deal with Iran. And a lot of the Gulf countries were afraid that the U.S. was abandoning them for Iran. And when they started this war on Yemen, one of the ways that the Obama administration could reassure the Gulf Sunni monarchies that we're still friends would be to support them. So the U.S. behind the scenes has given very substantial help to this war effort. It's not something that's publicly announced very much, but there was a leak that the U.S. military actually was helping to choose targets to be bombed in Houthi-held territory in Yemen. That's not just, you know, support. That's actual involvement. On the other hand, the same leaks say that the U.S. advised the Saudis against bombing civilian infrastructure. There were bridges that are necessary, you know, for people to get food around the country and supplies, and that the Saudis disregarded the American cautions, and they've bombed, you know, civilian ports, they've bombed bridges, they either are not very good at targeting, or they're deliberately hitting schools and hospitals, and they recently hit a prison.
And we should just say, the theory behind this is that they're doing this to basically say to the people, you better, it's in your best interest to get the Houthi out.
Yes.
Because if you don't, we're just going to keep bombing you, and there's nothing they can do to protect you.
Yeah, it's a series of war crimes, because they're basically holding the civilian population hostage to their demand for a political change. And it's exactly the same policy that the Israelis use in Gaza.
And in both instances, both of the people perpetrating these have the backing of the U.S. government.
Yes, I fear so.
And so, to what extent has there been? I mean, and now we're in a sort of, I guess, ceasefire negotiations. What are your sense of how they will, whether they'll be effective, whether it will hold? What happens next? And is there any reevaluation? I mean, it sounds to me like basically like the U.S. said to their crazy friend, go ahead, have fun, you know, just so that you know that we still got your back. And then at one point it was like, oh boy, maybe this is a little too far. You know, you've had enough. You know, maybe giving the keys, that type of thing. I mean, what happens next?
Yeah, well, the John Kerry and other administration officials have, on more than one occasion since last summer, said they expressed some discomfort with the prosecution of the war, is how they put it, diplomatically. And the U.S. military actually issued a statement in September after one of these bombings of civilians that it may have to reevaluate its participation in this campaign. But, you know, I think that might be for public consumption, because Washington is aware that this kind of thing is unpopular and draws international condemnation. But I haven't seen any evidence that the U.S. has actually backed off from its support for this war effort. I think that the Saudis will go on doing this as long as they think that they might thereby achieve some goal. And I think over time it will gradually become apparent that you can't, as I said, you can't defeat a guerrilla movement from the air. It's the basic mistake the United States made in Vietnam, and the Saudis are just playing the same movie over again. On the other hand, in the meantime, you are seeing a growing humanitarian catastrophe because Yemen wasn't doing very well. I mean, it's like the fourth or fifth poorest country in the world to begin with. And if you disrupt its transportation networks, its ports, its ability to deliver staples, then you're making most of the country food insecure, and you know, some large number of people actually are going to bed hungry now every night, and then people are being displaced from their homes on a large scale. And so you're setting up for another refugee catastrophe. A lot of Yemenis may flee across the Red Sea and make their way up to Libya and try to get to Europe. So it's a regional disaster.
And lastly, I mean, does Saudi Arabia, do they even have a significant army? It seems to me that they have like they're an air force, but they do a lot of outsourcing on this stuff.
The Saudis and their allies have not committed significant ground troops. The other Gulf monarchies, of course, are tiny population-wise, and they have put in some troops. The United Arab Emirates, for instance, has put in some troops, but the Houthis have managed to kill some of them. But you know, in a place like the United Arab Emirates in Dubai, one UAE soldier killed is a huge national tragedy because it's such a small place. I think one of their soccer players was killed, and that was, you know, the country was in mourning for weeks. So it raises questions about how much popular support there will be for this kind of thing over time. But no, the Saudis and their allies haven't put many troops on the ground, and the Saudi infantry is not thought to be capable. So they have a lot of very sophisticated fighter jets from the United States that they have bought, and those they seem to be able to deploy expertly. And then Morocco and Jordan, along with the Gulf monarchies like Bahrain and the UAE, have joined in as well.
Assuming Hillary Clinton becomes the next president, do you have a sense of what the trajectory will be on in terms of this region?
Well, Hillary Clinton gives every evidence of being extremely pro-Saudi and extremely pro-Israel. And so, you know, in a way it will be business as usual because Saudi Arabia and Israel are two pillars of American policy in the Middle East. She also seems to have animus against Iran. And you know, at one point she talked about nuking it. And so I think, you know, the Obama administration did step out of American traditional diplomacy in the region to some extent. It made that deal with Iran, which neither Israel nor Saudi Arabia wanted it to do. Obama said he, you know, made a declaration of independence. He declined to get involved in a big way in Syria, although both Israel and Saudi Arabia probably would have liked him to, certainly Saudi Arabia. So I think, in a way, those aberrations that Obama introduced of, you know, better relations with Iran, talking to your enemy, maybe less adventurism in the region, those things will maybe subside under Clinton, who will go back to the traditional way, American way of doing things, acting very closely in concert with Tel Aviv and Riyadh.
Professor Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick... Oh, you know what? Before we take a break, I want to do this Comey thing. There you have it. I mean, that's...
that last bit was, of course, I think sort of the biggest concerns that we have about Hillary Clinton around these parts. I mean, reverting to the mean, and I think there's, you know, until I think the American public, pays more attention to this, and I don't see any reason why they would, but perhaps there will be someone, and we've had these conversations in the past. There is basically at least a point person or two or three when it comes to influencing a Clinton administration in terms of domestic policy, and particularly when it comes to economics, regulatory state, all those questions, right? Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown and others are basically the point people for that agenda. There isn't, as far as I can tell, anybody in terms of foreign policy, right? Like, what's the face from Connecticut?
Chris Murphy's progressive foreign policy write-up, but I don't think he has that much clout for it.
Tim Kaine has shown a little bit, but well, I don't. What's he going to do? I mean, Russ Feingold, maybe.
Russ Feingold, yes, but I think Russ Feingold also will have. He might want to focus on areas that are less controversial. Like, she might continue to support things that he does in Africa, as an example, where he specializes in, and he doesn't have a bad record in. Maybe Obama himself. Like, if Obama intervenes, you know, if it's really a big disjuncture and says, hey.
I don't think so.
Oh, if he thinks his Iran legacy is threatened, I think so. Yes.
Wow.
So maybe so. But it wouldn't be like a major intervention.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
I like you just, when they go low, we go high, add low.
That's right. That's our saying around here now. When they go low, we go high and low. And then sometimes we even go lower. We go lower than them. Get underneath them. We smack them in the nose, and then we take out their ankles. Light their feet on fire. Here's something that is, and they've since changed this piece, but who wrote this? It was a Chris Klizza? In the Washington Post. I want to read to you, and this is coming from a tweet from Yoni Applebaum. And who is he? He's a journalist at the Atlantic.
Jewish guy.
And he took a screenshot of the lead from this Chris Klizza piece in the Washington Post. And it was fortunate that he did, because they had to change it. Listen to this, okay? And I want to get into, I want to use this to just reiterate my thoughts on Comey and the FBI, which seems to be in complete disarray right now. And I think I'm more sensitive to this than some other things, simply because I know somebody who was an assistant U.S. attorney who dealt specifically with public corruption, who told me that he actually, as a brand new assistant U.S. attorney, sat in an auditorium where James Comey got up there and said, the one thing I want you to walk out of this room with is an understanding, this is when Comey was the DOJ, of our role in protecting the institution and not being political or engaging in anything that could be perceived as being political. I mean,
not
the outrage, honestly, the outrage from former FBI and particularly Department of Justice people is incredible, apparently. But so I want to read this with that said. Part of the problem, too, is like we don't seem to have journalists. I mean, I you know, look. I don't know that much about things, generally speaking, but I don't opine on them if I don't know about them.
you know, I can do an interview and ask the professor about Yemen and about Mosul, but I'm not going to sit here and opine because I watched the movie. You know, I saw the Battle of Algiers. Let me tell you what I think. But the reason why I say that is because here is the lead of Chris Klizza's piece on what is happening to the FBI. The FBI has long been an iconic institution in American life. From Elliot Ness, apparently spelt incorrectly, to Clarice Starling. The image of the FBI, unflappable, smart, and relentlessly fair, has been sterling.
Wow.
Relentlessly fair.
Now,
unbelievable.
For those of you people, Elliot Ness, of course, was a Treasury agent. I guess maybe a precursor to the ATF, right? Or something like that. Not an FBI agent. And Clarice Starling doesn't exist except for in those movies.
Silence of the Lambs.
Silence of the Lambs. You know, she went after the guy who said, it will put the lotion in the basket, and was helped by that fictional character played by a British actor.
Great agent.
She was great in that movie. And she was, I mean, look, let's face it. She was also great in Bad News Bears, but that's also not. Was that her, Jodie Foster in Bad News Bears? No, that was Tatum O'Neill.
No,
I got them confused when they were kids.
I don't know, dude.
Nevertheless, I continue. After last week's announcement by FBI Director James Comey that the investigation in Hillary Clinton's private email server continues, it's hard to see it staying that way. Well, it's also hard to see it staying that way because it was never that way. you cite a non-FBI agent and a fictional character as to the brand of the FBI in this country, skipping over J. Edgar Hoover, for whom actually they still have buildings named, and who was perhaps, I don't know, the single longest-running, most corrupt person in the history of this country. I mean, I think if you were to take a Venn diagram of like...
The longevity wins it for him, I think.
Yeah, public officials and also, and longevity... But then also put in another circle that includes like needed in a position that really, really needed some measure of integrity, right? Because this is when we have our debates with libertarians and we talk about the monopoly of force. I'm not as concerned about the government's ability to say that you have to pay taxes. Where it really becomes a problem is in law enforcement. And that's why it's such an issue. You know, we talk about Black Lives Matter. You talk about cops who are supposed to be the one group of people in our day-to-day lives who we can go to if there's a problem. And you can't, because if you're black, you're not going to get protection or justice. You could actually, they become a source of a potential danger. That's why exactly when you have an FBI, the head of the FBI or the attorney general, they must be beyond reproach because they are the chief law enforcement officers essentially in the country. I mean, the attorney general is, the FBI is, I don't know, two or three, maybe two. And so the idea that they would not follow policy, this is not custom or tradition, this is policy that is not just like policy so that we can have a good process and whatnot. It is so that people can retain integrity in the fundamental aspect of our democratic system, right? That
the government isn't being used in some way to determine the outcome of elections. And he completely sacrificed that principle for what? Nobody knows. It's not like we've got to let the American public know that there may be some evidence of something about something out there, possibly. I mean, it's stunning. And here is Barack Obama speaking to it. And I hope what he's doing in this interview with now this, right, is laying the groundwork for firing Comey after the election. I hope that's what's going on here. Here it is.
I think the timing of this release or this letter that Comey sent to Congress is what's confusing a lot of people. Yeah. Were you yourself upset with the timing at all?
Well, you know, I've made a very deliberate effort to make sure that I don't look like I'm meddling in what are supposed to be independent processes for making these assessments. Setting aside the particulars of this case, I know that she is somebody who has always looked out for the interests of America and the American people first. And I do think that there is a norm that, you know, when there are investigations, we don't operate on innuendo, we don't operate on incomplete information, we don't operate on leaks. We operate based on concrete decisions that are made. When this was investigated thoroughly the last time, the conclusion of the FBI, the conclusion of the Justice Department, the conclusion of repeated congressional investigations was that she had made some mistakes, but that there wasn't anything there that was prosecutable.
Look, it goes beyond that. I've been told by someone who worked specifically in this business, if you will, prosecuting corrupt public officials, that they can't even, if they have enough evidence to charge someone, they can't move on it if it's within 3 or 4 months of an election. Even if they have enough evidence to charge someone, not that they found a bag on the street corner that they think might have evidence in it and then announce it to the world. Like, we found a bag. We don't have the right to look into it yet. We got to get a court order. And we're not going to be able to look into it until after the election. We just wanted to get it out there so everybody has all the facts. No. If they have evidence that they can charge a public official with, they still won't do it before an election because they don't want to meddle in that election. Stunning. What Comey did was stunning. And you can see the crap show it is unreleased. I mean, it's released with the FBI. I mean, it's just, they're leaking about all sorts of things. Both supposedly in favor and, that would help Clinton or hurt Clinton. But either way, ridiculous. They get a clean house in that FBI. I mean, clean house. And here's another idea. How about appointing a Democrat?
How about appointing someone with basic familiarity with Sharia law?
But
knows
honestly,
how this works.
Like, this idea that we're going to appoint a Republican because that's the way that we have a more integrity to our government. At one point, there should be an awareness that there's something going on with the Republican Party between the calls for impeachment for a president who's not even elected yet, for the refusal to do their job as senators and confirm the nominee of a president who's not only named the nominee, but is not even president yet. This is an attack on our form of government. It is not an attack against another political party. And there needs to be an awareness of those people who, are so invested in process and procedure that there is one massive element in our country that is determined to undermine those things. And that's not partisan bickering. That's just being aware of what's going on. It's shocking to me. All right, I had to get that off my chest. Now I have. Now we'll head to the fun half.
No one understands Islamic.
Little palate cleanser. Get us in the mood. Hey, folks, don't forget, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Become a member today. Join the Matoons. We haven't done that in a long time. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Also, Jet.com at MajorityReportKickback.com. Also, today we had a Harry's ad. Somebody asked me to just say this quickly. Harry's ad and a Movement Watch ad. Go to Majority.fm, support our sponsors. You can see what the discounts are available. What else? Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Is that what you're going to say? Yeah. Okay. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Tomorrow we got a great show for you. Great show. Cliff Schecter will be here.
Big league.
Andy Kindler.
Big league.
And the Good Liars.
Tremendous.
Yes. Probably an 8-hour show tomorrow. See you in a minute.